In 2017, Stephanie Savelle decided to make a map.
It was actually an idea that came up at one of our cost of war strategy meetings. Someone was like, well, we really should have a map of what we're talking about here.
Stephanie is one of the three directors of the Costs of War Project, which is housed at the Watson Institute. Its mission is to measure the true costs of America's post-9/11 wars, not just financial, but also human, political, and environmental.
It was founded by two professors, Dr. Catherine Lutz and Dr. Nita Crawford. They were both based at the Watson Institute. And at the time, it was 2011 was the 10-year mark of the post-9/11 wars.
Its founders started the project because they noticed a gap in information and reporting that existed about America's wars post-9/11.
There was very little questioning about the basic premise of, you know, should we even be waging this war to begin with? You know, what are our goals and are we accomplishing them? And is there a better strategy for meeting our goals?
The project started as an effort to gather data, often that's hidden from view, which could help Americans answer those questions. Stephanie joined the project in 2016, and that brings us back to that map, which she started the following year. The purpose of it was to identify all the countries where the U.S. was engaged in counterterrorism operations.
And I thought, okay, well, maybe this map is going to be like, maybe it's seven countries or something like that. And I just imagined something very simple, and I was like, sure, I can do that. Little did I know that I was kind of embarking on a research odyssey.
How could this become such an odyssey, you might ask? Well, first, they ran up against a surprisingly complicated question. How do you define military presence in the first place? A military base? Troops actively fighting? Do you include countries where American drones flew overhead? Let's even take what might be considered the most straightforward definition: U.S. soldiers physically fighting and dying in another country. Even that was surprisingly tough to count.
It ended up being this incredibly tricky thing to figure out because the U.S. military is not kind of advertising when that happens, certainly not in places like, you know, Niger. I don't know if you remember, but 2017 was the year that four U.S. soldiers died in Niger. And the public and Congress were like, what are we doing in Niger? I would just get bogged down in these long meetings where we were like, okay, well, there's this article that says there's troops on the ground in Cameroon, but there's no proof that they actually exchanged in gunfire. We were kind of having to make a distinction between, oh, there's some military exercises on the border with Russia. We're not going to include those because we're focused on the counterterrorism ones. Another example was a case in Libya where the U.S. military was engaged in some kind of a firefight with militant groups. And the way that I found out about that incident was that there were some service medals that were awarded to some of the service members who were involved in that firefight that day. And that was how I found out. It was just kind of an obscure reference that I was able to trace.
What Stephanie thought was going to be a quick project turned out to be almost as endless as the conflicts she was researching. And the total number of countries so far on the map, you ask?
We're conducting counterterrorism operations in 85 countries now.
That last example Stephanie mentioned about American deaths in Libya really sums up how we've understood these wars. Stephanie only learned about these deaths because of medals that were given to veterans. It's like we're supposed to celebrate our military without really asking them what they've been up to. From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. This fall marks 20 years of American military engagement following the events of 9/11. This year, we're teaming up with the Costs of War Project for a series of episodes looking at some of the hidden costs these scholars have exposed. On this episode, we'll be talking with two people. The first, whom you've already heard from here, is Stephanie Savelle. I talked with her not just about her endless map project, but also about the origins and motivations of the costs of war, and why, despite the U.S.'s recent withdrawal from Afghanistan, this project is far from over. Here's Stephanie again.
Since I've been leading the project, I guess it's been 5 years now, I've really been trying to connect our research to the public and kind of ramp up our ability to connect to journalists and editors, to share our findings with civil society groups and with members of Congress. We really see ourselves as aligned with a broader peace movement, and we work with a lot of civil society groups who are doing a lot of advocacy work.
Before we go any further, I wanted to ask you to clarify something. In your work, you do not use the phrase war on terror. You say post-9/11 wars. Can you explain that?
Using the term the war on terror is problematic for lots of different reasons. One reason is that terrorism is a political term. And so the people who are conducting a military operation have an incentive to name a certain group of people as terrorists because it justifies war and a military approach. Those same people, you could call them insurgents, or you could call them political opposition members, or you could call them militants. That's often the term I use. So it's really a way of obscuring rather than clarifying what's going on. And it's used in service of the people in power to perpetrate violence.
The military and the U.S. federal government keeps loads of statistics about everything. So why do we need the cost of war to do that as well?
Yes, the government keeps loads of statistics, but those statistics sometimes are obfuscating rather than clarifying, right? So, you know, the Pentagon puts out a number of like, this is how much the war has cost. And it discourages people from asking, well, what about the other ways that this is going to affect our federal budget and our society for generations? What the Pentagon does is put out a number. Their number of $1 trillion is purely based on a certain category of budgetary spending. It's a technical term for overseas contingency operations, OCO funding. And that's what they say that the war has cost. And we say, well, wait a minute. There are not just what the military has spent, but there's also, you know, veterans care is a huge expense of these post-9/11 wars. So is interest on borrowing to pay for these wars. There is the ways that the war has inflated the Pentagon's base budget. So all the equipment, the pay for troops to return to the war zones again and again, the ways that the Pentagon has kind of beefed up its network of bases around the world, all of these things have kind of been baked into the Pentagon's base budget, which is now at over $700 billion a year, which is this astronomical sum. And what you can see if you look historically is that after a conflict, that Pentagon's base budget is not going to go down. We have that under a category called increases to the Pentagon's base budget because of the post-9/11 wars. So all of those things go into our estimate that make it higher than what the Pentagon says.
Your group doesn't just count costs in dollars and cents and military spending, including veterans care, right? I mean, as astronomical as those are, how else do you define and measure the costs of war?
We talk about costs and think about costs in a really broad sense, just as you're saying. So it's not just economic, but also human, social, political, environmental. And I'll give you just a couple examples. One of them is the ways that the post-9/11 wars have intensified police militarization in the United States. So the flow of equipment from the military to our police departments, the flow of veterans into police departments who are hired as police, that has been an explicit strategy. Another example is the U.S. military, if it were a country, it would be ranked somewhere around 40th. In the amount of carbon emissions that it has. So it's the single highest institutional carbon emitter in the world. It's kind of ironic because the U.S. military often talks about the security threats of climate change, rising sea levels, increasing conflict, and that kind of thing. But when you dig into what's been the actual military's carbon emissions, it's a huge contributor to climate change.
How do service people and professionals in the military feel about your work? Are you like persona non grata?
It's interesting. I'm always struck by, if I give a public talk, like if I talk on the radio or something like that, I've often gotten emails afterwards from people in the military, even top leaders, being like, thank you so much for pushing the envelope. You guys need to keep getting this work out there. This information needs to get out to the public. There, we really share with a lot of service members a desire to lessen the chances that service members will die in war. And so in a lot of ways, we're actually on the same page, remarkably, with a lot of individuals.
Do you think anyone imagined when this project started that in 2021 it would still be going on?
Yeah, it's really discouraging to think about it this way, but there will always be a room for this project. And if it's not the post-9/11 wars, it's going to be the next form of U.S. militarism. The U.S., unfortunately, has a militarized status quo, and it's very hard to think about how that will change, and yet we must continue fighting for that change. Something that I've drawn a lot of inspiration from is this author, Rebecca Solnit. She writes about the origins of the abolitionist movement in England back in the, you know, early days, the 1700s, and how this small group of activists was kind of fighting this huge beast of slavery. And they were just considered, you know, extremist and radical and, you know, writing pamphlets and passing them out in the streets and that kind of thing. And she locates the beginning of the end of slavery with those activists. And sometimes I think about that because I think, you know, we're up against a similar kind of a enormous beast, you know, the military industrial complex, all the lobbying that goes on, all the corporations that have a stake in this, the ways that there are weapons manufacturers in almost, you know, every state, you know, they've kind of spread out so that they would be strategically located in a lot of Congress people's districts. So there are so many ways that this way of being is entrenched, and yet we can't not do anything. We have to work for a different way of life, really, in this country.
Stephanie, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Dollars and loss of life, blood and treasure, as it were, might be the first two costs you think of when it comes to war. But last year, a group with the Costs of War tallied another effect, and media outlets across the world took notice. It was a measure of human displacement, and the number was almost unfathomable. 37 million people.
That's as many people as live in Canada.
That's David Vine, one of the authors of the paper. He's a professor of anthropology at American University and the author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State. Our producer, Dan Richards, spoke with David about what this number means for America and the world, and what it still misses when it comes to understanding the human costs of mass displacement.
David Vine, thank you so much for talking with us on Trending Globally.
Thank you. I'm really excited to talk to you.
I was wondering if you could just describe, what are the different types of displacement, because it doesn't just mean one thing, and you have a few different definitions you use in these descriptions.
Yeah, when we talk about displacement, we're talking about, first and foremost, people who have been forced to flee war. We're not just talking about any kind of displacement or migration. We're talking about people fleeing for their lives. And in that total that we've now actually updated, we've documented 38 million people at least who have been displaced, 38 million people who have been forced to flee their homes by the eight most violent wars the U.S. military has been waging since 2001. And that includes both refugees, people who have been forced to flee outside their home countries, and internally displaced people. So in Afghanistan, for example, we have documented 5.9 million people who have fled their homes. And that includes 2.1 million refugees and 3.9 million internally displaced people. And surely the total exceeds 6 million now, just in the past few weeks since we updated our figures.
And so in Afghanistan, for example, there are more people, as you say, internally displaced, meaning they're fleeing their homes, but they're not leaving the country that they're in. But that in Afghanistan, that's a larger number than people who are leaving the country. I think that's something I hadn't really thought about. Did that surprise you at all, the level of internal displacement?
Internal displacement is always a major issue and has been worldwide. I think that the thing we can learn from the relative numbers of refugees and internally displaced people is that, of course, people don't want to flee their homes. And generally, when they do, they're seeking safety as close as possible to home. But frequently they realize, as many in Afghanistan now realize with the Taliban coming to power, that they have to escape Afghanistan completely. But frequently people travel shorter distances, and it's frequently the most privileged displaced people who are able to become refugees because they have the finances to cross a border or to make a longer distance migration that would require the funds to support yourself over long distances.
Another thing that really stood out to me in your research was the number of countries that have been affected in this way. And, you know, I think maybe to many Americans, it could be surprising that it's not just the one, two, or three countries we often think of as having U.S. military engagements with over the last 20 years.
Yeah, very, very few people in the United States know how broadly the U.S. military has been fighting since 2001. The global war on terror began in Afghanistan in October 2001, but quickly spread literally around the world, so that U.S. combat troops have been engaged in some form of war or combat in at least 25 countries in the past 20 years. So we focused on the 8 most violent wars that the United States has been engaged in since 2001. So that's Afghanistan and the overlapping war in Pakistan. That's also Iraq, of course, the war that began in 2003 and where U.S. troops are still engaged in fighting. And it also includes Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Syria, Libya. But as you noted, U.S. troops are engaged in many more countries where we were unable to document the full scale of displacement. So the 38 million figure is conservative in a couple respects. So we, in all our assumptions and all our methodologies, we were as careful as possible in our documentation. The actual total number of people displaced in these 8 most violent wars may actually reach 49 to as much as 60 million, which would put it on par with the displacement seen during World War II, to give people some sense of perspective. 38 million people, that's as many people as live in Canada. That's as many people as live in California.
It is incomprehensible almost.
It is, and that's why in our report and in our writing, we really encourage people to try to connect with the experience of just one displaced person. That it does become impossible, really, to comprehend what it means to have 38 million people displaced. So instead, I think it's much easier and important for each of us to reflect on what it would feel like if we were forced to flee our homes tonight. We should grapple with that experience of fear, of trauma. If I had to flee my home tonight, where the heck would I go? And those are the decisions that the displaced in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, and beyond. That's the kind of thinking they've been engaged in, and they've been forced to grapple with and then forced to find some safety.
What got you first interested in trying to tally these numbers?
I think first and foremost, it was because no one had done it. No one had bothered to document and calculate how many people have been displaced by the post-9/11 wars. The Cost of War Project has been amazing in documenting how many people have been killed by the post-9/11 wars, as well as the financial costs and other dimensions of the human damage inflicted by these wars. And when we think about the effects of war generally and the effects of the post-9/11 wars, we have to place displacement at the center of the analysis. But we together realized that no one had bothered to put together the numbers. And that is, I think, you know, part of the impetus for the entire project, that the U.S. government really has not informed the U.S. people what these wars have meant, these wars have meant for people in the United States and what they've meant for people in the war zones. And I think we're seeing now with the attention to Afghans who've been trying to flee Afghanistan, we're seeing growing attention to the experience of Afghans and to the plight of refugees in particular, which is encouraging to me, because I think when the issue gets more attention, people care. People can relate to people who are fleeing for their lives, and people want to support them. Of course, there is a tremendous amount of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee forms of racism and discrimination. But indeed, this is something that we can and have overcome in the past.
How many refugees from Afghanistan has the U.S. committed to admitting into the United States thus far?
The Biden administration prior to August had announced that it was only going to resettle a maximum of 62,500 refugees total from around the world in 2021 and 125,000 in 2022, 125,000 in 2022, although it then admitted actually they wouldn't even reach those targets. So in the last weeks of August, the United States evacuated around 114,000 Afghans from the Kabul airport alone. The U.S. has admitted relatively small numbers of Afghans up to this point. In fact, I'm quite sure that the 114,000 evacuated in the last days of August probably at very least doubled and perhaps tripled the number of Afghan refugees that have been resettled in the United States since 2001. So I've been calling on the Biden administration to announce a refugee cap of at least 300,000 a year for the next 5 years, if not 10 years. We can get stuck in the numbers. The bottom line is the United States can and must resettle drastically larger numbers of Afghan refugees and refugees from all the wars the United States has been engaged in. Let me just say one more thing. You know, some people may say that, oh, this is completely unrealistic to resettle a million Afghan refugees or a million Iraqi refugees. Again, I just would underline that the United States has done this before. The United States resettled more than a million Vietnamese refugees and tens of thousands more Lao and Cambodian refugees after the end of the U.S. war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. And other countries have been doing this. In little more than a year, in 2015 and 2016, Germany accepted more than a million refugees from Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, and beyond. Canada, on a per capita basis, has resettled far more refugees than the United States has.
Beyond admitting refugees into the United States, what are other ways to try and make up for these effects on people's lives?
I think war reparations have to be part of the answer. And war reparations, as they have in other wars, can take on many forms. What I've been calling for is not just for the United States to resettle more than a million Afghan refugees, and I think at least a million Iraqi refugees as well, but to also assist displaced Afghans, Iraqis, Pakistanis, Yemenis, and others where they are, first and foremost. Often they're displaced locally or regionally. And then to assist with the resettlement of refugees back in their home countries when conditions allow. Because, again, generally people want to return home when it is safe enough to go home. But again, I think we have to have a bigger conversation and go beyond conversation to take action. We have to, first and foremost, put the human effects of our foreign policy choices first. And I think they've been neglected for decades. And that's part of why I think the Cost of War Project is so important, because it has put the human impacts of war first. And I think we need to grapple with the damage, the human damage, first and foremost, that the U.S. government, the United States, has inflicted as a result of our wars.
David Vine, thank you so much for talking with us on Trending Globally.
Thank you again for having me on.
This episode was produced by Dan Richards. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Thanks again to Stephanie Savelle and David Vine for talking with us. We'll put links to all the research we discussed in the show notes. If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. And even better, tell a friend who you think might like the show to subscribe. You can learn more about the Watson Institute's other podcasts on our website. We'll put a link to that in the show notes too. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks for listening.